96.9 FM. Fresh news, smart talk, all day.
The views and opinions of the hosts and guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect the position of the management and staff of Guardian Network.
This morning, and welcome back to Guardian Radio, your station for fresh news, smart talk all day. It is Wednesday, the 9th of March, 2022, and you are on the clock with Erin Green. On the clock, we engage organizations, institutions, social and cultural leaders, and ordinary people to better understand the impact of public policy, private sector development, and emerging social and consumer trends. On the clock, we have conversations that help us understand and navigate a rapidly changing Bahamas. And I think we're going to have one of those conversations today. Absolutely. But before I bring in my guest for this morning's discussion, we're taking a look at today's headlines. This BPL story that's in the Tribune about fuel hedging. Well, I just want to let you all know that I began my BPL summer last week. It has already begun. And I'm not sure, quite sure that BPL understands the assignment. Now, I say BPL versus BEC because we know that even if BEC could understand the assignment, there's still no way that they could complete it. We know that. But BPL now, I wonder if you understand the assignment. I wonder if in this, 2016, 2017, 2018, 2019, 2020, 2021, 2022, I wonder if you all understand yet your obligation to answer to the people through whatever mechanism is in place, right? I wonder if you all get that yet. Because the last thing I recall is one BPL board telling the general public and stakeholders that they're not answering anybody questions. They're certainly not answering questions put to the old board. And I just want BPL to know that it doesn't matter what state the company, the corporation is in, you still owe us, the people, a regular, frequent, working every day. Like, you owe us a in communications and explanations about what's going on at this power company. See, because y'all use this, this is what you say, that the work is so important that it warrants these hefty salaries. Even if we can't actually deliver on our goals or promises, right, or projections. The job is so important that we require these hefty salaries. Let me tell you why the job is important. The job is important because electricity, access to electricity, is now a basic human right. Because electricity is required to participate in the world now. Right? I would say congratulations to Mr. Leon Williams and his recent appointment to the UN. Leon Williams went on Lester Cox's show, made a statement that Bahamian politicians are dragging the past into the future. And I want to paraphrase that and say Bahamian politicians are dragging Bahamians into a future that they, the politicians, barely understand. And they, the people that are being dragged, can hardly understand or conceptualize. Right? That's what's happening. This job is so important. You can't use online banking services without some form of electricity. You have to charge your devices. All of those computers run on electricity. And how is it that you are dragging your country into a future that you, the government, the political class, the business sector, the professional class, cannot sustain? Y'all just can't. The emperor is naked. And everybody running around here like they've been to the best seamstress. And my money is good. Make me one of them suit. And you know, on every corner, there's a Bahamian willing to oblige. I still trying to connect the story where the chairman of Focal seems to be speaking on matters that are outside of his scope of authority. I don't care that you are supplying the fuel. I don't care that you are now, surprisingly, the company that is providing the generators to turn the fuel that you're also providing into electricity. I don't care about any of that because BPL and the Ministry of Works and the cabinet, they're supposed to be making these decisions. And they're supposed to be engaging us, the people, on these decisions, about these decisions, before they're made. So to wake up and to see today's paper, BPL hedging deal hits new layer of confusion. More questions raised over BPL fuel hedging. And what I don't see is these headlines, more questions raised over missing file outlining investigation into the fire. More questions raised over missing file into the investigation over the oil that has been leaking in the water near their facility, from their facilities, for decades. What y'all getting paid for? What is it? Is it so that I could have to live a life where I have to call BPL when my power goes off because BPL doesn't know that my power is off? I was waiting to see if the electricity would kick out. That's what the pause was about. I am a child of the generation of children that fared growing up because your electricity was the same as your mortgage. Your electricity is the same as your rent. Tell me, who waking at BPL. Y'all got Bobo Togi and Omar Archer waking at BPL. What's going on? Anyway, to those people who are responsible for BPL, and I hope y'all realize that even at the end of the day, you're still not responsible for yourself. Will you speak to the Bahamian people clearly and loudly and tell us what is happening and tell us what we can expect in the near future? Our lives are not collateral damage. In your pursuit of wealth and happiness, that is not what a country is for. At some point, you're going to need an ACR. You're going to need an evaluation. Somebody has to come to the table and be called to account. Because I am 45 years old. And my whole life has been an energy crisis. And y'all are getting paid as if y'all are actually doing a job. But it's obvious on the surface, y'all are not doing a good job. Okay, guys, I see the call line. Let me tell y'all what is happening today. I could not make that note. I've been talking about Alstom 2.0. Alstom 3.0 for years, and people have laughed at me. And all I could tell them is, if only I were worthy enough to be the type of citizen in your country that deserves, you know, a job where I could have my own BPL bill. But I'm not, apparently. And so I stand in defense of those who are and have to pay that bill, because it's not just that access to electricity is a basic human right. It has to be a basic human right, because you all are creating a world and dragging us into a world where you cannot participate, you cannot live comfortably, a basic, adequate, comfortable life without electricity. Let's get to these texts very quickly. Morning, are you talking about Minis? No, I'm not talking about Minis. Great show as usual. Is there an island-wide purge going on because people killing like they have a license to kill in Nassau? Great show as usual. Also, the government announced on the new day they don't want no Bahamians do business with no Russians. Ms. Green, we have mortgage, light bill, school fee, and gas to put in our car. I think Mr. Mitchell is delusional, and most of us have something call a sweetheart bill, which is more than the mortgage they need to get real. The text says, I think they have the Three Stooges working to BPL, Curly, Larry, and Moe, because in the summer, my light bill always more than my mortgage. My own is $650. Nassau is not a real place. Well, listen, for decades, I have been pointing out that there must be a problem both with the management and the labor side of BEC. And I wrestle with that, right, in my critique, in my assessment of what was going on. And I always lay the majority of the blame on administration and management. But after we heard the report about the quote-unquote social club, do unions have fraternities? I don't know. A social club called the Supper of Doom? What? That's what y'all been doing while y'all supposed to be running an essential service in our country? No, man. No. Like a good friend say, no, sir. No, sir. All right, callers, we got 60 seconds. I got a segue to my next section. Good morning, caller. You're on the clock.
Good morning, Ms. Green. How you doing?
I'm good. Thank you, Sparky. How you doing?
Right, yeah. You know, this stuff with BPL, BEC, whoever they are, becoming so repetitious. We be just saying the same thing over and over, year after year, month after year, and then this board come in, the next board go out, everybody on the same questions, nothing is happening. But do these same board members, the people we pay all this money to dress up and give them car gas and suits and everything. Do they use the same electrical wires that we use in their homes and everything? Does their electricity go off?
I'm not sure. And if it does, I wonder if they have generators and that's why they...
If the Prime Minister, the Governor General, the Queen, the First Lady, and all, do they use electricity in their homes or they got...
The Honorable Perry Christie installed solar panels on his residence. Well, that's when we were supposed to shut the whole thing down, you know.
Yeah, but I was checking on solar the other day, and the lowest price I even hear starting is something around $15,000. I don't know what class of maybe I had, middle class, low class, what class. How much people walk around here with $15,000 when they tell us that the average payment don't hardly have $100 in their bank account? Have a good day.
Thank you, Sparky. $15,000, let me tell you, though, how you have to do it. First of all, you got to form a co-op, right? You got to find a group of people that you trust, and you form a co-op to purchase the solar panels. And if you can't form a co-op to purchase the panels for personal or residential use, then you're going to form an informal co-op through contract. But you have to buy it in a group. You have to buy in bulk. And it from solar panels straight down to salt and sugar. We're going to have to start employing different practices. And see, that's going to be a big cultural shift, you know. That's going to be a big, huge cultural shift. Because we used to, see, money is power for us. And so we used to spending our money, when we want. Not waiting for the group to meet and make a decision, come to consensus. We're not used to that. So you're going to take a big shift, but that's the only way we're going to be able to do it. But I'm telling you all, decades of this madness. The return on investment for solar will pay for itself a few times in 25 years in the savings on electric costs, etc. 25 years is a whole lifetime. Caller, you're on the clock. Still there, caller? I am sorry I missed you. Producer, let's go to a break. And when we get back from the break, we will be talking with Alicia Wallace from Equality Bahamas. And we're talking about International Women's Day. And I'm going to ask the question about marital rape. Stay tuned to Guardian Radio 96.9 FM. We will be right back.
Throughout our lifetime, we must all make decisions. No matter how we choose, the right one just needs to be made. Like having J.S. Johnson Insurance Agents and Brokers as your insurance partner. We've been serving the Bahamas for over 100 years. Whether you need home, motor, marine, or commercial insurance, make the right decision. Call 397-2100 or visit jsjohnson.com.
J.S.C., 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 J.S. Johnson Insurance.
How important collecting your money can be to the success of your business. Start your relationship with Fidelity today so that we can show you the many options available to you with our merchant services, pay options online, to merchant terminals and e-commerce options. We're here to help your business succeed. For more details, speak to one of our business development officers at 356-7764 in Nassau or 352-6676 in Freeport. Visit our website at fidelitygroup.com or visit any of our branches.
Fidelity, we're good for you.
MB, let me see your money. It ain't right, it ain't fair. Area you know you're supposed to declare.
Welcome back to Guardian Radio 96.9 FM. You are on the clock with Erin Green, and I would like to introduce my guest for today. It's Alicia Wallace. How are you?
Good morning, Erin. I'm doing well. How are you?
I am good. Good. Thank you. So,
awesome.
Tell people briefly who you are, what Equality Bahamas is, and then we're going to get right into the questions.
I am a feminist, gender expert, a research consultant, and I am a team member at Equality Bahamas, which promotes women's and LGBTQI plus people's rights as human rights, primarily through advocacy, public education, and community engagement. And one of the things that we're probably best known for is our monthly event series, Women's Wednesdays, where we bring women together to talk about issues of personal, national, regional, and global interest and importance.
Absolutely. Okay, so let's start here by framing out the conversation, right? So two things I definitely want to talk about. The theme for International Women's Day globally is breaking the bias, but I noticed that Equality Bahamas chose a different and specific theme for their local campaign. Tell us why you chose building the gender machinery for your theme this year.
We chose it based on the work that we've been doing over the past with, I guess, more intensity over the past few months as the country has been having conversations to varying degrees about gender-based violence. As you know, we had the 16 days global campaign in November, which ran into December, where we looked specifically at gender-based violence and actually started to introduce people to a number of international mechanisms. And we started talking about some of the reform that we need to see here, that we're hoping to see, that might be coming soon. And, you know, the more we talk about these issues and engage citizens and residents of the Bahamas in these conversations, the more we realize that a lot of the tools and resources that should be available to us are out of reach, not just because they haven't been implemented yet, our laws haven't been passed yet, but because we haven't been provided with the information about what they are, why they exist, how the Bahamas has a relationship with them. So for example, the Convention for the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women, which we call CEDAW, mm-hmm. Known as the Women's Bill of Rights. When that comes up, a lot of people tense up, feeling like it's some foreign entity, foreign body, foreign agenda in the Bahamas, not recognizing that this is a treaty body that the Bahamas willingly, freely signed on to because it recognized it as important and as something that needed to be integrated into national law and policy. And if we don't have an understanding of what these mechanisms are and why they exist and how they would impact our lives if properly implemented, then there will always be resistance. So one of the things that we really wanted to focus on moving from the 16 days campaign into our full 365 days of activism is looking at some of these pieces, the different documents, different policies, the different draft pieces of legislation that have been discussed in the public when particular issues are raised. So we've heard about, for example, the gender-based violence bill. We've heard many times about the strategic plan on gender-based violence. We've heard about the gender policy, the draft gender policy that very few people have seen. So we need to know what these documents are. And then you're starting to hear people saying, we need to pass this bill. We need to implement this policy. But we recognize that we need to know what's in that bill. What is in that policy? What does it mean? What will be its actual effect in people's lives? How will it affect the law? How will the law change? What does that mean for us? How can we use it for our benefit? How will it advance women's rights? How would it move us toward gender equality? Are there gaps? Are there challenges? What are the things that we need to look at? So we're creating and be in conversation with experts and practitioners to get a better understanding of these documents, looking at them and hearing the interpretations of them. And the theme of building the gender machinery really comes from, well, even before the Beijing Platform for Action and before CEDAW, there was conversation about the need for there to be a central unit within governments that are responsible for the advancement of women, responsible for putting in place policies and practices and leading programs and activities that move us in that direction.
So,
and
Go on.
We haven't really done that yet. We've had, you know, the gender desk, we had the Women's Bureau, now we have the Department of Gender and Family Affairs, which should be our national gender machinery, but it's not properly equipped. It's under-resourced. It's not really functioning in that way. It's not helping to move us forward in the way that it should. And in the absence of that national gender machinery, Equality of Bahamas decided that, you know, we're going to step up and look at some of the tools that we do have and figure out how we can make them, familiarize people with them, help people to understand them, compile these tools, and look at how we can advocate for them to be properly implemented and used at the government level so that we, in a way, create our own gender machinery alongside or in the absence of a proper one within the government.
Absolutely. Wow. Okay, so we talk about a unit that should work at the national level, right? So we're talking about, for instance, the Freedom of Information Act comes along with an information commissioner and an office, right, of the information commissioner. And then there will be information officers that are placed or appointed from each ministry, right, that coordinates with the information officer. Are we talking about a structure like that where there's a person in every ministry that ensures that ministry is aligned with the national gender policy? Or are we talking about something slightly different?
So I think what you're mainstreaming, so making sure that gender is a consideration across the board in all departments and all ministries within government, okay, where the gender machinery is its own body, its own unit, mm-hmm, that's functioning to have oversight of the development of laws and things like that. So I can tell you from the Beijing Platform for Action, it very specifically says a national machinery for the advancement of women is the central policy coordinating unit inside government. And this is a quote. Its main task is to support government-wide mainstreaming of a gender equality perspective in all policy areas. The necessary conditions for an effective functioning of national machineries include, and then it goes on to list that this machinery, this unit, is supposed to be at the highest level in government, with the responsible person being a cabinet minister. So we're already missing out on that, right? Because the Department of Gender and Family Affairs is a department,
right,
under a ministry. So it's not at the highest possible level. Mm-hmm. It needs to have sufficient resources in terms of budget as well as professional capacity. It doesn't really have that either. It needs to have the opportunity to influence development of all government policies. It needs to have institutional mechanisms or processes to allow for decentralization of planning and the involvement of non-governmental organizations within these processes.
While you were referencing that, I thought about sort of the environmental sector and the fact that it appears as if EIAs are requested and submitted after the agreement has been made. And in this instance, when we're talking about gender now, what we're saying is that we want the experts at the table while the policy is being made or to inform the policy. And we don't want a situation where we're consulting them after a policy has been created, a law has been drafted, or a decision has been made.
Exactly. I wouldn't even call it consultation if it's happening after the fact. That's sort of like a feedback session, right? Here's what we're going to do. What do you think? Yes or no? Mm-hmm. That's not true consultation. That's not what it looks like.
Absolutely. So let's talk about consultation briefly. I had a very, very strong word about the National Gender-Based Violence Discriminatory Law Review Forum that took place on February the 17th, 2022. And I want to reiterate that the department and the ministry responsible, they certainly reached out to me. They extended an invitation, more than one invitation. They followed up. My concern and critique of the event and the process is it does not include that, right? They certainly reached out to the more diverse and fringe members of our community to speak candidly. And so that's not my critique, but I had a heavy, heavy critique for them. And I want to ask you, because you took part in the National Gender-Based Violence Discriminatory Law Review Forum, when the Prime Minister said recently that he was prepared essentially to take recommendations from us, I shuddered a bit. I'm not sure if we have reached the stage in that consultative process where we can be pulling recommendations from it. What did you think about the event, and how could the review process be better structured to produce more coherent and effective policies and law and legal recommendations?
The event itself was definitely rushed. Invitations came maybe a week before the first day. The documents that needed to be reviewed, I think, maybe were made available on the day or the day before. So participants really didn't have time to dig into these documents that were not short. We're not talking about 5 or 10 page documents. We're talking about 90 page documents that aren't, you can't read them once and, you know, just read it and then have an opinion or have recommendations. You really need to read it carefully. You need to make notes. You need to reference similar documents, similar bills and policies, in be able to compare and contrast with other countries, particularly within the region, that have made similar steps recently. Mm-hmm. You need to be able to discuss it with constituents. So for example, Equality Bahamas does not make a practice of us sitting together in our little group and making decisions. We're always connecting with community members. We're always asking, what do you think about this? How is this affecting you? What are the solutions that you have in mind? How can we build something better? Because we have to engage the people that we're serving. So just on that level alone, the event was putting NGOs and representatives in positions where they were supposed to make sweeping decisions that they cannot just represent without engaging. So that was a major issue for me. I think that it could have definitely been better moderated because, you know, of course, you're going to get dissenting views. Some of them definitely I would characterize as anti-rights views, but those need to be moderated. There need to be responses.
Which is problematic because the National Gender Equality Policy was developed on the basis of a human rights framework.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Sorry, go on.
So that's definitely an issue. Seeing that people were in the room, particularly from the Department of Gender and Family Affairs, that I don't want to say that they weren't capable, but they didn't seem prepared to intervene or to provide information, to present facts, to refute some of the claims that were being made, and to advocate for rights and to quote conventions that we are party to.
Absolutely. What I would have done, the preparation for an event like this, it requires 6 months. Right? When you think about the number of organizations and government entities that you want to participate. And you have to identify coordinators for sectors of civil society. And then you need to give those civil society organizations and individuals who want to participate an information packet 6 months in advance and assign them a coordinator so that they can interact with that coordinator and possibly have organizational meetings with the event team to ensure that when we do get to the table in 6 months' time, not only can we have a coherent dialogue, but we can have an effective and efficient discussion. Alicia, that's our music. We're going to a break, and when we come back from the break, we're going to talk about disproportionality, towards reversing discrimination in law, political and social will, and the Sexual Offenses Act, and how are we going to deal with this troublesome issue of marital rape? Stay tuned to Guardian Radio 96.9 FM. We will be right back.
Hello, I am Brenda Smith, Senior Manager of Training and Development and Coordinator of the Vaccination Program Health at the Sandilands Rehabilitation Center. For many persons, contemplating taking the vaccine can be daunting. But by getting the facts, you are placed in a better position to make an informed decision. I am happy to say that I am fully vaccinated. I made after weighing the benefits of taking the vaccine versus the risk of not taking it. By getting vaccinated for COVID-19, I am not only protecting those I encounter, but also protecting myself from becoming very ill if exposed. I can't tell you how important that is for persons like me who have chronic health conditions like diabetes and hypertension. The trainer in me encourages you to learn the facts about the COVID-19 vaccine and compare the advantages and disadvantages. Remember, the greater numbers vaccinated, the greater opportunity for us to return to life as usual.
This message has been brought to you by the Public Hospitals Authority and the Sandilands Rehabilitation Center.
It's bodacious.
Uh-huh. C-sharp. Boom, bop.
Ice the coconut, got this. Cocoa skin driven madness. Juiciness, ice the back, this.
Sweet like a sugar in a.
Dripping like ice, huh? Me, I dick. All the men love me. My lips, sugar cane, rub me.
Sweet like a sugar in a.
Good morning. Welcome back to Guardian Radio 96.9 FM. Again, you are on the clock with Erin Green and Alicia Wallace. Alicia, good morning. Still there?
I'm here.
Good, good. So I listed off four things that I wanted to touch on. 12 minutes left. I wanted to talk about disproportionality, right? And helping like the dominant class, in this instance, men, understand their experience of violence, oppression, or discrimination. Like if we were talking about race globally, we would say the dominant class would be white people, right? And we would be helping white people understand their experience of violence, oppression, or discrimination in the, you know, in the context or juxtaposed to a broader experience, right? What other people are also experiencing. And how do we say to men and to women that yes, men do experience violence, they do experience some degrees of oppression, discrimination, even prejudice, but it's not in proportion to what women experience and what women have experienced historically.
That's the challenge, Erin, and I think we're still trying to figure that out. Mm-hmm. And it's difficult because it's hard to see outside of your own experience. It's a practice. It's something that you have to be intentionally practicing and thinking about what is someone else experiencing. Because even if we think about our experiences as women, we know that my experience and your experience, Erin, are going to be different for various reasons, right? Because of our parents, because of the way that we speak, because of the generations that are assigned to us. And our experiences are going to be different from other women who might be employed, might be married with children. We're having different experiences for all of these reasons. And that applies across or between genders as well. And we have to encourage men to think outside of their own experiences and to understand that it's okay to have specific conversations about the experiences and the specific needs of women. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean that we're negating the experiences or the specific needs of men, but understand that these are different and that they're happening at different rates and with different levels of intensity. And we have to be able to recognize that.
Absolutely. The reason why I just wanted to mention that briefly and we're going to move on, right? I think about this all the time. I think that men have difficulty navigating relationships and negotiating intimacies with women sometimes because their trauma or the obstacles, you know, that they're trying to push through are related to their relationships with their mothers when they were little boys, right? And that power dynamic is so intense, the mother over the boy, that even when you become an adult male, right, you still feel like a child when you're engaging women, and thus it feels so oppressed, like hurtful and intense, right, what it is that you're feeling. And so I want to say to men, though, that you still have to view your experiences individually and collectively juxtaposed to the experiences of others. Another quick question. Do you think that we have the political and social will to continue this process, the road to gender equality and gender equity? And just a quick...
We're still building it. We're not there yet. It depends on the social will. It doesn't seem to come on its own.
Absolutely. Our last sort of topic for the morning, Alicia, I could be honest with you. I'm looking for a space to talk about marital rape on my show. And yesterday, it was intentional. I wanted to highlight women in agriculture and environment because the whole country is talking about marital rape and gender-based violence for the last couple of weeks. But let's try and get some of these questions in. What does rape is rape mean? Because it seems as if... the political class and the maybe the judiciary, I'm not quite sure, I don't know if I'm hearing enough of them, don't understand what rape is rape means.
Yeah, it's an interesting question because it seems to answer itself. Rape is rape. Mm-hmm. Rape is not anything else. Rape is not sex. I think that's the main thing that we're trying to get across when we repeat rape is rape, because the two are constantly conflated and they are nowhere near the same.
Right.
And we could sex requires consent.
Right. We could have a whole show on that. And I want to, and I'm going to ask you to find a therapist, a psychologist, a guidance counselor who would be comfortable talking about this, because we have to remember that there are people who have experienced rape, have been, they've witnessed it, they've observed it. Little boys who've watched their mothers be raped in the family home, right? Little girls who've watched their mothers and their older sisters or their little brothers be raped in the family home, in the school, in the community. And sometimes we don't realize the extent to which people are traumatized by this basic sort of conversation. And I say that to the people who think this ain't a real important conversation. Like, why are we talking about this? But if the experience of rape and sexual assault by women in their lifetimes, and if we imagine, because I don't think we have any sound stats on the experience of rape and sexual assault by men and boys, then a whole bunch of people in the Bahamas have experienced some form of sexual assault, whether it's rape or sexual harassment, or a simple, like a molestation. There are hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people who are directly impacted by these conversations about rape generally and about marital rape specifically. Is there any room for compromise on this issue of creating a different name for the act?
Absolutely not. It's unacceptable to call rape anything other than what it is. It is rape. It doesn't matter if you put a word and if you put rape, you know, marital in front of it to indicate that it's happening, quote unquote, within a marriage or between spouses, it's still rape.
Absolutely.
Calling it something else is to suggest that when it takes place within marriage, it's less vile or less violent or more acceptable. And, you know, to do that is to really validate the idea that women are less than human beings, that women give up any personhood that we do have if we choose to marry, yeah, and that we are essentially objects.
But, and I think it's actually the reverse, that surely it is a far more traumatic experience being raped or violated by someone that you love or trust.
I agree.
And that must be the cognitive dissonance required to hold this space is problematic, right? And I don't know if as a man brave enough to marry me, I just listened to Avi's song called I Ain't Going Home. If a man come to my house and say, this man drunk hot dog sauce, I may marry him just on that alone, right? I'm not married, but why would you want to maintain a relationship with someone who has decided that they're going to do that regardless of how you feel? And doesn't that act break the sacrament of marriage? Like, is it okay? We could call it rape because when that thing occurs, the sacrament itself has been altered such that it can no longer exist.
Yep, I agree. But on the question of why people stay, you know, mm-hmm. we can connect that to the reason that the people stay in abusive relationships. More generally speaking, it's difficult to leave, especially if you're financially dependent on the person. You have to be able to acquire, save the resources, in particular financial resources, to be able to live on your own. You have to secure your own safety. So, you know, the workplace is a place that domestic violence extends to. The person knows where you work. We know that it becomes more dangerous when a person leaves. We know that it takes, on average, 7 times for a person in an abusive relationship to leave and actually stay out of that relationship. So all of these things come together, and it goes back to, if we could look at the amendment bill, that seeks to criminalize marital rape. That's one of the major issues in that bill, is this temporal limitation that it can, obviously, based on what I just said, that's a serious issue because people need to be able to leave in order to be able to safely report. And it definitely, in many cases, takes more than 1 year to be able to safely, permanently leave.
Right. Absolutely. Absolutely. Alicia, we are almost all out of time. I got this text here that says, note to Mr. Monroe, the objective isn't to get convictions per se, but rather the objective is to stop women from being sexually abused in a marriage. And I will go further and sort of make it gender neutral and say the objective is to stop sexual abuse, harassment, and rape, and help people better relate to each other. Because at the end of the day, men and women who are allowed to get married and people who want to live together, they want to find solutions and resolutions that bring them closer together and not tear them apart. And that's another discussion that we absolutely need to have as well. Ms. Wallace, I'm all out of time, but that's okay because I'm committed to having you back on with some of your team members later in the month. I gotta go. That's my music playing. And up next is Guardian Radio AM with Mr. Hubert Edwards. One last word, Alicia, very quickly.
We have an event this evening looking at SDG 5 on gender equality. Folks can register at tiny.cc/IWDSDG5. So International Women's Day Sustainable Development Goals 5.
Absolutely. Thank you so much and can't wait to have you back. To my producer, thank you very much. Maybe play that song for me as we head out. And remember, stay tuned. Guardian Radio AM with Mr. Hubert Edwards is up next.